a big price is paid by Owen Meany. And this sense of sacrifice equates to a lot of people to being the one that Jesus Christ made as on the cross. And so there is this development of the two ideas, I think, all of the time. I have to say unashamedly, I like the more lugubrious music. I'm a Requiem man, love them, but, you know, not exclusively. But I do think that some of the finest music has been created from that sense in which we have to go inside ourselves and actually understand why we're here. And, you know, we're not immortal. You know, there is a moment when things will finish. And I think composers have actually, I mean, they've been unbelievably inspired by that and produced some of the finest music as a result, whether it's, for me, 1605 and Victoria's Requiem, or whether it's Berlioz and his thundering giant drums, or Verdi, terrifyingly so, in Dies Irae, and so on. I think it's just produced some of the most extraordinary, violent, and exquisite music.
Well, I am afraid that that is where our time has run out. And so I would like to ask you to thank David Hill and David Bamber very much. And David Hill's Prom from the Angry Planet is on the 5th of August.
Anne McElvoy, who presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event. The producer was Allegra McIlroy. And a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Susie Klein, still to come tonight from the BBC Philharmonic and conductor laureate Gianandrea Nozeda, a performance of Mahler's most misunderstood symphony, the 7th. It has no programme, no extra musical idea driving it, there's no singer in this piece. This is the composer's most purely abstract work. But what it does have is the most extraordinary use of the orchestra, combining instruments and colours in a way that Mahler never had done before. For tonight's conductor, Gianandrea Nozeda, the 7th is a futuristic piece, pushing the boundaries of what an orchestra can do.
Mahler was very imaginative. He had a lot of visions. He tried to find new sounds. But he didn't have the live electronics. He didn't have the electronic music. If Mahler would have been living in the 50s, probably could have been one of the greatest Moderna, Nono, all these kind of Stockhausen, all these kind of men, very curious. He found the way to put, for instance, the cowbells in a symphony. He did already in the 6th symphony. He does again in the 7th. He put the mandolin and the guitar. I was wondering, why guitar and mandolin? Of course, it's an act music, but it's not written as a serenade, serenata. And serenata in Italy is something you go with a mandolin and a guitar just under the balcony where you try to seduce the lady. But this music doesn't sound this way. So it's a serenade, night music, and night music for what? But he uses the same instruments. So that's why it's always a rebus, an enigma, a mystery. And you have to go through imagining what he's aiming from. I don't know. Probably from the beginning, which is a sort of Trauer March, to arrive to this joyful finale, which doesn't sound completely joyful to me. It's like if I don't feel, I feel a little bit depressed, but I don't want to show it. So when I meet other people, I try to overact, just to show over-exaggerated, over-the-top happiness. I think the finale sounds a little bit like that. So it's more Mahler in the beginning of the symphony and the first act music, especially in the scherzo, which is just the center point of all the symphonies.
Gianandrea Nozeda here to conduct the players of the BBC Philharmonic in Mahler's 7th symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
the close of Mahler's Seventh Symphony. The performance here at the BBC Proms, given tonight by the BBC Philharmonic and its conductor laureate, Gian Andrea Nozeda. He told me earlier, this is such a dark piece, so difficult to conduct. Sometimes the depths you have to plumb with this symphony make it such an emotionally bumpy ride. He says he won't conduct Mahler's Third more than once every 3 or 4 years because you have to look after your heart and it might be dangerous to perform it more often than that. The leader of the BBC Philharmonic, Yuri Torchinsky, on his feet now, applauding fellow members of this orchestra. Such a great atmosphere here today. Fantastic for them to be reunited with a conductor whom they've worked with for so many years, almost a decade. Gian Andrea Nozeda was at the helm of the BBC Philharmonic in this, the second of four proms they're giving at this season, 2012 proms. Maestro himself returning to the stage now to congratulate his players. Fantastic warmth between all of them. And that performance of Mahler's Seventh Symphony concluding tonight's concert. Don't forget that, as always, you can hear it again via the BBC iPlayer and every concert of the Proms broadcast live right here on Radio 3. We will be back again tomorrow, but for now, it's time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Susie, thank you very much indeed. Susie Klein at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight. And as she said, you can hear it again, that concert, on the Radio 3 website. If you prefer, you can hear it again on the radio when the recording will be broadcast a week today at 2 o'clock during Afternoon on 3. Well, yes, tomorrow night we're going to be paying not one but two visits to the Royal Albert Hall. First of all at 7 o'clock to hear a colourful all-English programme given by the combined forces of the BBC Symphony Chorus, the BBC National Chorus and Orchestra of Wales, all conducted by another stalwart of a BBC band, Tadaaki Otakar. The Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis is the opening number in that concert. We've also got music by John Ireland, The Walk to the Paradise Garden by Delius, and to end, Walton's Belshazzar's Feast, which should certainly raise the roof tomorrow night in the hall. Then we have a late prom tomorrow evening. That's given by the Radio 3 World Roots Academy protégé, the accordion player José Hernando Arias Nogueira. He's going to be playing a programme of Vallenato music from Colombia, new songs and old ones, with a whole host of Colombian musicians in support. That late prom begins here on Radio 3, live from the Royal Albert Hall at 10:15 tomorrow night. Full details on the Radio 3 website. Well, a very good evening to you from me, Ian Skelly. Our next programme tonight is the next in our summer series of Lebrecht interviews. And tonight, Norman Lebrecht will be talking to the Hungarian conductor, Ivan Fischer, who will reflect on his many groundbreaking musical achievements and the more than his fair share of political controversy. You can hear what that was and what caused it too tonight at 10 o'clock. Then we'll trace the history of money this evening. We're going to head back 11,000 years to when cattle were first domesticated and very quickly became units of exchange. Cows and Shells, the title of our essay series tonight and this week at 10:45. And that's followed by an exciting new jazz collaboration between the Scandinavian free jazz trio, The Thing, and the vocalist Naina Cherry. Jez Nelson will be here to explain in Jazz on 3, which begins tonight at 11 o'clock. But it's a little after 9:45 now, and next tonight, music from France. Piano music by Saint-Saëns, a piece composed actually as a test piece for a competition in 1894. Music dedicated to the brother-in-law of his piano duet partner, the composer Thomas Ambroise. It's played here by Piers Lane. Thank you. Music by Saint-Saëns, a theme and variations in effect, is Opus 97, played there by Piers Lane. Well, with an eye on tomorrow night's first of two proms from the Royal Albert Hall, an all-English programme, particularly the Vaughan Williams tomorrow night, the Fantasia on a theme of Thomas Tallis, which opens the concert, I thought I'd take you to 10 o'clock and our next programme this evening, the Lebrecht interview with Ivan Fischer, with some English music for the clarinet. This is by a Lloyd Webber, William Lloyd Webber, who studied under Vaughan Williams at the Royal College of Music in London and dedicated this air and variations to one of his colleagues when he returned there as Professor of Composition. It's played here by the clarinetist John Bradbury and the pianist James Cryer.
Thank you.
an air and variations by William Lloyd Webber, dedicated to Frederick Thurston and his pupils at the Royal College of Music. It was played there by the clarinetist John Bradbury and the pianist James Cryer. And plenty more English music, as I say, tomorrow night on Radio 3 in the first of our two proms given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Tadaaki Ottokar. Vaughan Williams to begin, John Ireland, Delius and Walton's Belshazzar's Feast, all live from the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3 from the earlier time of 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Well, in 45 minutes, how cows and shells began the process that became a universal form of exchange. The history of money explored in our essays this week at 11:15. But first, with the time at just after 10, here's Norman Lebrecht with the Lebrecht interview.
Ivan Fischer stands in the line of Hungarians who invented and developed the conducting profession. Hans Richter and Arthur Nikisch were co-founders. Anton Seidel, Eugene Ormandy, Antal Dorati, George Self, Fritz Reiner, the American pioneers, Ferenc Fritschoy in Berlin, István Kertész and George Scholte led the next generation. No small nation has made so huge an impact on any performing art. Ivan and his brother Adam Fischer grew up under communism and made their names on both sides of the Iron Curtain. Now, both have fallen out with their country, taking a principled stand against a right-wing government and rising racialism. Born into a musical family in 1951, Ivan enjoyed an elite communist education. He then studied in Vienna with Hans Swarovski and Nikolaus Harnoncourt. He got started in Britain as music director of Kent Opera and the Northern Symphonia in the 1970s. He's also been music director at Lyon in France and is about to enter a new job with the Concerthaus Orchestra in Berlin. His chief involvement, though, is with the Budapest Festival Orchestra that he founded with Zoltán Kocsis 30 years ago and with which he has made dozens of recordings. He's fallen out badly with Kocsis over national politics and now divides his time between Budapest and Amsterdam, where we meet in his living room. Ivan Fischer, living in more than one country is a Hungarian tradition. It goes back to Franz Liszt and his Vie trifurcée, a life divided three ways. Why is it that so many Hungarian artists feel such a need to be rooted somewhere else?
It's a dividing line. There are the Hungarians who stayed and the Hungarians who left. And it seems to me that there is a clear line between the cosmopolitan Hungarians and the nationalist Hungarians. It's always been like that. We remember when Gustav Mahler used to be the opera director in Budapest, he got into very, very heavy conflict with the then nationalist Hungarian camp. And these are names people know less in the Western world, like the Erkel family. Mm. We know Ferenc Erkel, who wrote the big nationalist Hungarian operas, but his son, Sándor Erkel, was a conductor who had a very important reputation in Hungary, but nobody knew him outside of Hungary.
It's a double insecurity, isn't it? That the fear of being an outsider in a nationalist society, so you have to live somewhere else, or the fear of staying and then being regarded as provincial and mediocre.
I don't know if it's fear. One should look at examples. Béla Bartók stayed there and had very strong feelings for being Hungarian. Mm. Although he immediately recognized that being a nationalist is something he wanted to distance himself very, very clearly. For example, when he started to collect next to Hungarian also Romanian and Slovak folk songs and extended his work into the neighboring countries. Mm. He was seen as a traitor in Hungary, Bartók, at that time in the 30s. And then he got to the point where he said, now I have to leave, because when the Horthy regime became more and more friendly with the Nazis, he reached the point, this is the time to leave. And I think in his case, it wasn't really fear. He wasn't Jewish, he wasn't threatened physically, he had very strong moral standards. And on the other hand, for example, somebody like Zoltán Kodály, his friend, stayed. Kod, I had much more to fear because he did have a Jewish wife. Yes. So it's interesting. It comes down to personalities.
And there was this three-way split, wasn't there, between the composers at that time. Bartók left on principle. Kodály stayed and kept very quiet. And Ernő Dohnányi collaborated.
Yes, this collaboration is a disputed story. Because
it always is.
Then it's natural. Now. Yes. I couldn't agree more. I mean, in the case of Furtwängler or all of them, in case of Dohnányi, there is one photo which really damaged his reputation, where he appears together with the Szálasi, the Nazi leader of a Hungarian Nazi party. And he stayed in position, like Furtwängler did and many others. I wouldn't go as far as seeing him as a collaborator, but he didn't distance himself, that's true.
You were born into a family that you described as musical, intellectual, Hungarian, and Jewish. In which order did these qualities strike you as a child?
Well, it's a very, very mixed, blurred picture, because it wasn't a religious Jewish family, very much like most of the East or Central European musical families. Maybe the grandfather was an observant Jew, but my father, for example, wasn't anymore. So somewhere somebody made the step to step out of religion, but because of having this desire or being used to adore something or believe in something, they somehow passed their idols from divine things to cultural things. So also in our family, you know, Goethe, Beethoven, Mozart were looked upon as gods in a way. And maybe we didn't discuss the Talmud, but we discussed everything around culture.
You grew up opposite the opera house where Mahler conducted, just across the road from where you live.
Yes.
So it's almost an extension of your living room.
Well, in Boris Godunov, for example, where we sang in the children's choir a few years later, the children sing in the first coronation scene, and then again when they take the money from the fool near the end of the opera. And between the two scenes, we had time to go home for dinner. And the great fun was that we could go home for dinner in costumes and have our dinner and go back to the second scene and take the money from the fool.
And then 1970, 71, you went to Vienna. Did you go together with Adam?
No, Adam went first.
Adam went
and
first.
I joined him a year later.
And he went to study with Swarovski.
Swarovski.
But you weren't going to be a conductor, you were a cellist.
No, cellist, that's right.
So how did you get into Swarovski's class?
Well, he always wanted to be a conductor.
Adam.
So he knew from his rather early childhood that this was like his ambition. And I was a very different character. It's difficult to describe this, but he was more the obedient child who, in a way, realized what our father's image was. And I was very different. I was more the difficult child who argued and discussed things, and I didn't agree with many things, and I was looking for other areas. I was very much interested in theater, especially avant-garde theater at the time. And then I went to Vienna as a cellist. I knew that I wasn't really somebody who concentrates on playing the instrument. I was searching for something else. And then I went to visit the classroom of my brother, and Swarovski was the most important personality in that music academy. There were other things too, but Swarovski's class was the magnetic classroom where everybody wanted to be in. So I thought, maybe I should try that too. But in the same time, I also studied with Nicolas Harnoncourt, who he taught wonderfully. It was just about the meaning of music, and I loved it. It was a course for early music for anybody, singers, instrumentalists, conductors.
And what were the different things you got from Swarovski and Harnoncourt? Swarovski was Hungarian. He was a very celebrated conducting teacher. He taught Abado, he taught Zubmeta, many others, Sinopoli. He was a specialist conducting teacher, and Harnoncourt was a self-made philosopher of early music.
I think both were. Swarovski had very strong mind and fantastic ideas, and Harnoncourt too, completely the opposite. Swarovski was somebody of the neue Sachlichkeit. This is everything rational, everything factual. He said, this is not about some mystery, it's about a G flat and a F sharp and that's it. And only the structure matters in music. This is Swarovski. Harnoncourt, on the other side, read between the lines. The score is only a shorthand. There are messages there which you have to discover. It's about feelings. It's about communication. It's about rhetoric, all kinds of things. It was the opposite.
And then you went to London. You won a competition. And the rest of the 70s is Northern Sinfonia.
That was a few years later.
Yeah, a little later. And Kent Opera. Tell me about Kent Opera, because you must have realized when you started working there that it was always about 5 minutes from being closed down. It was a pioneering company which had also done early music and had done new works by Tippett, but existed financially on a shoestring.
I will tell you about Kent Opera, which is a beautiful story. But before that, I would like to just briefly describe between the competition in 1967 and joining Kent Opera in 82, those 6 years I spent going from one orchestra to the next. I had many invitations as guest conductors, and I also worked with the Northern Sinfonia for a few years. But I had fantastic offers. I had a world tour with the London Symphony Orchestra, and I didn't like it. And I remember sitting in a hotel room and making notes about this is all wrong and this is not how an orchestra should function. And there is a major problem about the symphony orchestra as a phenomenon, and nobody thinks about the future of orchestras, and nobody solves the problems. And I developed a whole reform idea in my mind, in many, many notes, how an orchestra should actually work. And in 82, I came to the point that I said, I stop with this profession completely, because I didn't like conducting these orchestras. And at that time, two things happened to me. One was that I met Kent Opera. Kent Opera invited me, and suddenly there was this fantastic idealism, a young opera company with a young orchestra and a fantastic mentality, which I will describe. And in the same time, I went back to Hungary, and a lot of musicians came to me and said, why don't we do something? And I had the feeling that this is where I can put my reform ideas into practice and start an entirely new orchestra.
Describe Kent Opera. It must have been the least Hungarian place to go in the world.
Yes, but the idea, the idealism was enormous. Norman Platt was the founder of Kent Opera. Norman had strong ideas. First of all, he wanted to take operas to the regions. He wanted to make cheap opera for people who simply loved the operas. It had to be in the language of the listeners. Singers had to make sure that the listeners understand the words and follow the story. No subtitles, no original language. It had to be productions which are simple, minimal, and are completely in harmony with the meaning of the opera and the music. And in the balance of visual and acoustic experience, music had to come first. And I came in a time when there was a break between Norman Platt and Roger Norrington. Roger Norrington just went through these metamorphoses that he got fascinated by period instruments and early music, which he didn't do before this 82 year and wanted to change the Kent Opera into a kind of authentic
period company.
And Norman Platt didn't like it because his main priority was communication to the audiences and not to satisfy any scientific or other things. And they clashed about this principle. There was nothing else, but this was an important issue. Roger left and Norman Platt called me, and it was a great few years I spent with this company.
And were you there at the end? Were you there when it was shut down?
Yes, of course. I was at 105 Piccadilly discussing...
At the Arts Council?
Yes, discussing the cutting of Kent Opera with the...
Can you describe that?
Well,
you kill an opera company?
Well, this particular killing was very unusual because the Duke of Kent, in a way, not completely in harmony with protocol, decided to stand up for Kent Opera and came with us to the Arts Council. So we were sitting around the table and there were these Arts Council officials on one side and the Duke of Kent and me and a few others on the other side of the table. And can you imagine this amazing situation? And he very generously said that, I hope you can do something to save this wonderful company. And those gentlemen explained us why they don't. And it was all about saving this very, very small subsidy Kent Opera received and probably transferring to others. This issue can be read about in Norman Platt's book about Kent Opera, which I highly urge everybody to read. But I think it still hasn't been completely unveiled what were the real reasons why the Arts Council decided to make this very drastic move and how interconnected the Arts Council's officials were with other regional opera companies. This is a very, very difficult issue, which I don't know any details. Norman was very daring in his book, but I think it should be once looked at very carefully.
You had a suspicion of corruption?
I don't think it was corruption. I wouldn't like to accuse anybody of anything like that. But interests. I mean, of course, everybody was fighting for more subsidy and all the other regional companies. And there were a few of them who also were in various advising panels of the Arts Council. But I don't know anything more than that.
Tell me about your principles in founding the Budapest Festival Orchestra. It was just so different from anything else that existed in Budapest, a command economy, and you were founding a private orchestra. What were the principles behind it?
One major goal was to create an orchestra where jadedness has no chance, where the apathy or the kind of passive nature cannot enter. And in order to do that, I did various studies how to encourage the creativity of the individual. So let's imagine you would join an orchestra, you win an audition, you sit down at the fifth desk of a violin session. From that moment, you are required to follow the conductor, to follow the concertmaster, not stick out, but go with the group. And I thought, how do we promote somebody like this? Where is room for individuality? Where is room for your creativity if you have something to offer? And if there is none, naturally, you become, after a while, a little tired and you lose your motivation. You may lose your love for the music. So I wanted to form an orchestra where the individual has a chance to stay creative and fulfill various ambitions. And in order to do that, I had to introduce many, many practical differences to the usual orchestral setup.
Such as?
Well, for example, one thing is how much does an orchestra play? I had a certain feeling that to play as much as symphony orchestras nowadays do is a little too much, because it's tiring for the musician. So we limited the orchestral work to 30 weeks in a year. And then the rest of the time is filled with various things where the individual creativity can have channels of possibilities.
Teaching, communication, how?
It's more like a conversation with the person. Just try to imagine you are one of the musicians. I would sit down with you and say, what interests you? Do you have any special territory? For example, one of our violinists said that he made a serious research in early 19th century Hungarian music, what was played in Hungarian sort of aristocratic mansions. Said, wonderful, then why don't you make a cycle of those concerts? You can visit the mansions and do mansion concerts. You program it, you choose your partners, and put a little chamber orchestra together and play Bihari and Rozsavölgyi and this, you know, this great repertoire. There's another person said he's really into contemporary music, and now he formed an ensemble, and he has his dates, and he looks after those concerts.
There must have been a lot of opposition from government, society, other musicians, other orchestras.
There was jealousy, you're right. And also a little bit about some of the ideas we had, because we don't offer job security, we don't have a union. It's completely freelance orchestra, and it's in the founding document. There was a democratic vote of the first generation, of the first musicians, and they democratically decided that there should be no job security and no trade union in this orchestra. Only music should matter.
Who owns the orchestra?
It's a foundation. And there's a board of directors who appoint me.
Your co-founder, the Budapest Festival Orchestra, was Zoltán Kocsis, brilliant pianist who was becoming a conductor. You were jointly in charge at the beginning, and the beginning was very happy.
Very, very is maybe a strong word. Okay. was let's say, reasonably happy. We always had differences from the first day. And I think the differences he and I had were about how to work with people and how to treat people. He's, I think, a genius musician, wonderful pianist. And he also started to conduct, and I absolutely encouraged that. I was the first one who said, do it, you're doing it very well. Of course, one needs to learn and one needs certain experience, but he offered something which most conductors don't offer, a very high level of musicianship. The difference was how to treat the orchestra. He is somebody who dictates from above, and I wanted to work through the creativity of the musicians, encouraging them, giving opportunities, making sure, taking away the fear factor, for example. And he was much more dictatorial, who kind of pushed this general good feeling down, and that was the reason for the clash.
Did you have to ask him to leave?
Well, we had big, big problems at the end because I didn't agree with some things he did. And then at a certain point, I told him, look, Zoli, there is no point. We pull this orchestra in two directions. If you want to do it, I will leave. Fine. He said, no. I mean, from the start, you were the leader of this orchestra. He was there, but he was never really leading it.
The last time we spoke, Zoltán Kocsis was music director of the Hungarian National Philharmonic, and you were accusing him of collaborating with right-wing elements in the government. Do you still believe that he sold out to the forces?
Well, I never accused him of that. I don't think I ever did. I would, I don't remember having said that, but I also don't think it's true. I think he made one particular unfortunate interview in the Süddeutsche Zeitung where he just avoided to be critical at a time where I think everybody should be critical. And of course, it all comes down to subsidy, which orchestra is subsidized and to what degree. And the Hungarian National Philharmonic received very generous subsidies of the state, and we were always seen as a little independent, opinionated, critical lot. So he is like the protocol orchestra's music director, having good relations with whatever government comes into Hungary, and avoiding to be critical. I think that's all, but not really more than that.
You were supposed to be working together on a joint Bartók edition, a recorded edition.
Yes. There was this Bartók, the new Bartók edition of Hungaroton. This is what you're referring to. Mm-hmm. Hungaroton, a state-owned company, was privatized in the early 90s. And then they became like a shoestring company after that. They announced, I don't remember how many years ago, like 6, 7, 8 years ago, that they want to make a new Bartók recorded edition, mainly with Zoltán Kocsis as the, I don't know, musical leader who would record most of the recordings, but it's under his leadership. Everybody welcomed it, and I also welcomed this idea, nothing wrong with it. But then they asked for state subsidy, and they received this state subsidy with the arguments, and I had only problems about the arguments, which said that it's absolutely necessary that Bartók is being presented in its authentic national Hungarian form as it should be, and in our generation leaves a document of Bartók with its real Hungarian authenticity. And many of the musicians, including me, protested against this because we said, what about Solti? What about other pianists like Dezső Ránki? What about me with the Budapest Festival Orchestra? Aren't we Hungarian? We have been doing Bartók recordings all these years without any state subsidy and without anybody saying this is the real thing. How can you say that this is all non-Hungarian and now we need the real Hungarian authentic Bartók being performed, and that is the justification for the edition and for the state subsidizing this edition? So we thought this argumentation is not correct, and that led to a little public debate.
Ivan, what's gone wrong with Hungary in the democratic era? A boom economy has gone bust, and a right-wing government is now fostering ultra-nationalists. A neo-Nazi playwright has been put in charge of a Budapest theatre. The Speaker of Parliament celebrates a poet who praised Hitler. The Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, sits in Parliament while one of his MPs repleats the blood libel against the Jews. The pianist András Schiff has said he will never play there again. Your brother Adam called on the European Parliament to